Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, deep truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that in some way or another bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence.
Hi, and thanks for joining us for today's program. Coming up, John takes some guidance from the Tarot of the Shi in an attempt to find his authentic magic, which leads him to consider the differences between sorcery and shamanism, ego and spirit. John then invites Daniel Foer of AncestralMedicine.org and the Earth Medicine Alliance in for a spirited conversation about the ancestors and the self. After all, our ancestors should have some impact on who we are, right? Expect some surprises when Daniel turns the tables from introspection to extrospectation in the search for the self. Finally, John reflects on just exactly who the host of Convergence is and what to do with him. Join us for all the twists, turns, fun, and surprises. Next up, the first inscription above the Oracle at Delphi was, "Know Thyself." On a quest to discover just how to do that, John is joined by his co-hosts, Deb, Heisi, and Mildred Lynn, and our weekly roundtable discussion.
Well, welcome, everybody, to this week's roundtable. I'm John Carosella, together with my host, Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Good morning.
And Heisi.
Hello.
And our roundtable topic for today is one of the inscriptions over the Oracle of Delphi. And that inscription is, "Know Thyself." And I'm sort of interested in going into this territory because I know that I'm looking for my personal magic. I'm looking for where my power lives, right? I'm looking for how I can be most effective for the highest good, right, in the world. And I feel like one of the things that's required to know your magic is to have a clear understanding of who you are. Because otherwise, it seems that one can be pursuing goals and pursuing gifts and trying to develop capacities that you're attracted to out of a dysfunction in yourself or out of an illusion. And so not being clear about and not having an accurate representation of who you are would seem to be an impediment to developing your true gifts. So I was just wondering, how do you know when you know yourself? How do you know that you know yourself versus experiencing some illusion about yourself? Where do you go and what do? And how do you develop some kind of sense of the true you?
I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, it's going to be a short round table.
I don't really know how to answer that question because I think it takes your whole lifetime because it's an unfolding. We may have come into this physical body with an understanding of why we were here, why we are coming here. But that knowledge isn't given to us as we incarnate here. And it takes us this lifetime to discover who we are. And to know who we are. It's not I woke up this morning and bam, I know that I'm a this, 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 and this, and therefore I need to do all of these things to work towards that or to better that or to bring myself to a higher level in that regard. It's how do you know yourself? I think you do the best that you can in the moment. And I think if you feel true and centered in who you are within a given situation, within a moment, within a thought, within a decision, that's probably as close as you're going to get to knowing yourself at that moment.
So for you, it's a sense of situational integrity. I am responding this way in this situation, therefore that's likely to be who I am.
And there are going to be times, and there have been times, when life will surprise you. You will act or behave or respond in a manner that's like, oh, I had no idea that I would behave that way or respond that way or be that person in that moment. But I was. What does that mean? Am I okay with that? Was that actually truly who I am? So I think it's hindsight that we put towards knowing who we are, knowing thyself. It's not necessarily a projection forward except for the ability to say, that is what I would aspire to. That is what I hope or who I hope I am. May I build to that? But I think only in hindsight, when we have a chance to look back at what we have done and who we are and how we've responded, that we have an inkling of who we are. Who is myself?
Well, I think one aspect of that phrase speaks to that, because when I hear that phrase, it sounds like an imperative. Mm-hmm. Like it's saying, take this action to know thyself. So when you're surprised by something in life, and then you are surprised perhaps by a reaction or a way that you are in that situation, the imperative of that phrase says, take action to now explore that and understand why and where that came from as a reaction, especially because it surprised you compared to the image or the vision that you had of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Because it may be who you were and who you're becoming is starting to emerge. This is a clue or an indication. Now, if you can go on that quest and start to explore that more, you can start to allow that to emerge and become more of a conscious way of being, rather than it just becoming something that remains in the subconscious realm and doesn't have a chance to be expressed or to be fully evolved. And I also was thinking about that phrase as if it's the oracle itself reminding anyone coming in to receive a message from the oracle or an answer from the oracle, that ultimately you know this yourself. And so if you take the time to get in touch with, uncover layers of yourself and go deeper into yourself to know yourself more and better, to connect with that core, with that divinity or whatever within yourself, you'll realize you don't need to even come to me to ask, because you know. You know this yourself. Because it's not just telling me to go and know myself, but it's also saying that there's nothing that I don't know within myself if I simply take the time and put the effort into exploring that.
John, you were asking, how do you know if you know yourself? And what I would throw back is to observe how many times or how many masks you wear. Because if you're wearing a mask, you may not necessarily be yourself,
right.
Or know yourself.
Right.
So I throw out there for our listeners, observe yourself for a week and see how often you wear a mask, where you wear a mask, how you feel when you're wearing a mask, how you feel when you take your mask off. And the second part would be to observe who you identify with, mm-hmm. not what they do, but on a core level.
Example.
Well, it wouldn't be a character in a book, or it wouldn't be someone that you see in a movie, but it could be who they are as a human being. It's on a deeper level.
So potentials are like coworkers, friends, colleagues, family.
Yes, anybody who's on your path, and the objective would be to observe. and you may see elements of this person that resonate deeply with you in your core, not in your head, not in the realm of the belief systems. We hold the same beliefs, but something energetically in your core. And if you're feeling that resonance with the person, then you can use that as an exploration tool, maybe to help identify who you are.
So Deb's comment about observe your reactions in the present moment. And, you know, what immediately came to mind for me was, yeah, but people react from their dysfunction often in the present moment. And that's not the person you want to be, right? You want to be, I guess maybe the nature of the question more precisely would have been, how do I know my healed self?
But I think what you were just saying, that most people respond from dysfunction, is they then don't want to explore why they're reacting that way. Instead, they fall back to the excuse of, if somebody said, man, why did you react that way? You know, or why'd you get so upset about that? What would they say? Well, that's just how I am.
Right.
And so they're using that as an excuse, as if that is who they are, rather than being willing to go into the exploration of who they really are and where that's coming from, so that they can perhaps accept that that doesn't have to be who they are.
Well, okay, so that's the thing, right? That actually is a very reasonable assessment of who they are in that moment. The question is, how do they know whether it's from dysfunction or whether it's from a healed place?
Well, because know thyself says explore that to see, is this really who you are? Is this angry person you just displayed really who you are? And if you tell people, I'm not really such an angry person, it just seemed that way or whatever, then you don't really know yourself, because you're displaying one self but not exploring who you really are in order to not show that to the world who you are not.
Hmm.
So if you did know who you are, what benefit is that to your life?
If you did know?
Yeah.
Well, I think about it this way. Like, if I could operate from my most complete healed self, then all of my exertions, all of my efforts, everything that I engage in the world and everything that I choose to develop in myself would be a really good return on investment.
The bad word.
Well, I know. But the idea that I'm here for a purpose, right? I'm here to ideally share my gifts in a way that enhances the world. It would seem to me that if I could operate from my truest self, my most whole self, then my best gifts can come out in the most constructive, productive way possible.
But I think return on investment is, that's a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I think back to a roundtable we had recently about a particular poem called Do It Anyway, there was many lines in there that said, if you build it, they may destroy it. Build it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you're happy, somebody may be jealous. Be happy anyway. Well, that's saying there may not be a return on your investment, but that doesn't mean it's not worth investing in to be that or to do that. So I don't think that the measure is always going to be a return on the investment versus simply, is it worth doing in that moment?
Okay, I think that's a useful distinction. And yet, I still feel like if I could do those things from my highest, best, most healed self, I would enjoy it more, and the world would enjoy it more. Right? It would be better.
Betterer.
Betterer. More betterer.
But isn't that the point of living? The point of living is to get there. It's the journey to be that, to unfold. The point of living isn't to
please the shareholders every quarter with what you've done, what kind of return you've had.
It's not to sit for a week and a half in complete, total introspection and say, ah, there it is, I found it, that's who I am, and now I'm going to move forward and that's what I'm going to be and work from that point ever forward.
Okay, so it's harvesting from your experience, but that compels you to have experiences in order to be able to harvest something.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Or have less grand designs on the world.
Harvesting from one's experience. I guess in some way this is how we know, is we examine our behavior in the world and discern whether, first of all, we accept that that is who we were in that moment. That is who we expressed ourselves to be, and that matters, right? You can't say, well, that's not who I am, if that's how you express yourself, because that, in fact, means that's what you brought out. And then to take the time to
question, was that the best you? Was that the most evolved you? And then to learn from that and say, did that work? Did that serve a purpose, or did it not? And therefore, how do I not do that again if it didn't seem to work right or serve a purpose that was good? And what do I learn from that that I can continue to do if it did?
Right.
And to be at peace with that.
Now, what does that feel like?
I think that's an entirely different roundtable.
So, when you said question, reminded me of a teaching that I received from Tom Cowan in a Celtic shamanism weekend about the Grail Mysteries. The whole topic of the weekend was the Grail Mysteries. And he talked about the quest, right? And, you know, every Grail quest, the whole notion of the Grail quest is vague, right? It doesn't have we don't even know what the Grail is, right? It's never really described. But there's something that these men are questing for. And what I found interesting was that there are women in these Grail stories, but they never quest. And in fact, it's not that they're passive and it's not that they don't get involved. It's that apparently they don't have to quest. They even say, well, I'll meet you at the city where the Grail is, as if the guy is going to have to go out and do all this questing and the woman's just going to, you know, take the next train and meet him there.
And she knows where it is.
And she knows where it is. Right. She knows how to get there.
And she didn't share it.
So what I thought was interesting, you know, in reflecting on this, is that maybe there's an aspect of yin and yang and divine masculine and divine feminine in this question, where the divine masculine, the active principle, says, let's go find it. And the divine feminine says, let's let it come to me. Let's let it reveal itself naturally. And I wonder how that resonates with you guys.
Well, because the divine feminine says, you have the wisdom to know this already, but if it was just given to you, then you would never grow or evolve. And the divine masculine understands the importance of the journey for growth and evolution. And so while what you are seeking is actually always there, it's through the journey to uncover it or feel as if you've discovered it that you grow and evolve.
And perhaps that's how you come to understand it, as opposed to, right. You know, like the difference between unconscious competence of a child that doesn't think of limitations, and then we go into this dark period where we struggle to arrive at a place when we're elders, a place of wisdom, where now we know that we know.
What's the difference between high-level philosophical discussion versus how does that apply on the everyday level? And the divine masculine goes through the process of figuring out, understanding, and exploring and experimenting. How does this wisdom apply, and how can it be used, and how does it best serve on the everyday level in this experience of being human? Whereas the divine feminine simply is the wisdom. So it's there to be accessed or to be arrived at, but it's through applying it, experiencing it, experimenting with it that we actually grow and evolve through it.
So if we want to explore this topic out in the world, how do we do that? What's one way for us to engage the question?
Well, for me, I get very frustrated because anytime people meet new people, the conversation almost always seems to be, what's your name and what do you do? As if you're defined by your work. Usually what do you do means what kind of work or where do you work.
Right, so the know thyself would mean, well, my name's John and I do a radio show.
Right. Or I'm an engineer. Therefore, whatever you know about engineers, whatever your stereotype of engineers is, that's who I am, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And I would rather people... There's maybe other ways to go around this, but because being this direct may freak people out a little bit. But, you know, I'd rather people, when they meet someone, say, hi, it's nice to meet you. So who are you? Mm-hmm. Because that would challenge people to have to then actually talk about who they are. And you know, maybe other people have suggestions on how to go about doing that in a less challenging
yes.
way.
I have a personal antidote for one that has tiptoed through the tulips of that area. I did go through, and it's something I would not recommend. Please learn from my experience. I was exploring a concept similar to what Hi C was talking about, and so when people would ask me, who are you? I would say, I'm a human being. And when they would ask, well, what do you do? I say, I'm living my life. And although I thought they were great answers at the time that I would like someone to explore on, nobody seemed interested or quite knew what to do with that context. And if I did have someone who was brave enough to needle to forge on, I found that they kept going back to the trying to put me in a box. Mm. And the box always had to do with what was my profession. And until we reached that magical point where they could put me in the box, there was an awkward dynamic, an energetic dynamic between us. Now, I did not have the skill or the insight at the time to recognize that there was probably a way to be in integrity with that particular belief system that I was holding and say it in a way that was socially acceptable, that encouraged conversation. So my intention was good, but my execution needed a lot of work.
What do you think was the nature of the discomfort, and why did it get relieved when they could put you in the box?
Because I was not playing the game.
Oh, okay.
I was not playing the game that we have all been socialized to play.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's what I put it down to.
And okay. People don't want to really have to think. They want it very quick, easy, tidy, and, oh, okay, got it, now on to the next thing. You
right.
know, I mean, at this point, it's kind of like, tell me who you are in 140 characters or less. And if it's any longer than that, I've lost interest.
Mm. Mm. Right. Right.
So understanding, if you have an understanding of the box, you've already, in your own mind, there's all kinds of context that goes along with that, and you already are that much farther along in the thinking you understand who this person is and where they come from and what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to run across someone who's in a box that you don't understand, you know, they work in a profession that you don't have a lot of experience with or whatever, then you have the option of exploring that, learning, or perhaps saying, oh, that's very nice, and moving on, you know?
Right, right. Whereas, so what do we suggest instead?
Well, I think earlier in our conversation, Hi-C had a question that you ask people, why are you here? Or what brought you to this event?
Yeah, like what brought
right.
you here?
If you're meeting people in a social situation. And that allowed people the opportunity to share about themselves as opposed to simply giving themselves a label.
Yeah, if you're at a fundraiser, if you said, what brings you here? They may say, my mother died of breast cancer, so I like to come to these fundraisers to support cancer research or whatever.
Right, right.
So all of a sudden, you've opened the door and provided a way to reveal much more about who they are, what makes them tick, rather than simply the box of a profession or a label.
Right.
So that question is, so what brings you here?
Yeah, and I think that you can also say something like, tell me a little bit about who you are, and your background, which doesn't necessarily mean your job.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it would be interesting to do it even in what seem like mundane situations, like if you bump into somebody at the grocery store or strike up a conversation with them in line. Oh, what brings you here?
milk.
but usually people would not stop there. They would say, well, I came because I needed some milk, because I'm making a cake and I realized I didn't have milk, but I wanted to make a cake for dinner tonight because it's my son's birthday, and na-na-na-na. So again, it seems to kind of be the type of question that prompts greater exploration or revelation from a person.
Interesting that it allows for the expression of the self without the need for a box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really cool.
Or the need for a mask.
Mm.
Because when I'm hearing those two questions, they're disarming. People seem to bypass protocol and they go right in there to real.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that's not threatening.
Yeah.
And they don't feel vulnerable in responding to that kind of question. So know thyself is really, I think, about observing one's behavior and circumstance. and examining those reactions to see if we like them and where they come from as a way of determining how much of that person we want to continue to be. And then what? Just
have fun with it.
Having fun with it.
Laugh at yourself.
Don't assume you know who you are, because who you may become can surprise you.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. Be open to the adventure.
Yeah.
Each day is new.
And it's always wonderful to discover a new aspect of yourself, especially if you're a Leo.
All right. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's roundtable. Please join us for the rest of the show. And next week, we will be doing our monthly live call-in show. So join us for next week as well.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning.
Bye now.
Are you creating your own non-optimal reality? Might your hidden beliefs be hijacking your manifestation machinery? Join shamanist, radio host, and compassionate adventure guide, John Carosella, on a journey to the places where beliefs hide at East West Bookstore in Mountain View on Thursday, February 21st. Identify the great fear we all share. Discover how beliefs can blind us to soul loss. Freeing ourselves from hidden beliefs allows us to heal ourselves and in turn, the world around us. What beliefs are you willing to release in order to be healed? Mark your calendar. Thursday, February 21st at East West Bookstore in Mountain View. It's free. Register at www.eastwest.com/events.
So, the first major arcana card, after the Fool, which is the Zeroeth, is the Magician. I asked the cards a few weeks ago for some guidance on where I am along my path. And using the Tarot of the She by Emily Carding, the Magician came up, reversed. In a way, that reading is the inspiration for this month's show, The Magician, Reversed. Something is blocking my magic. In the movie Bagger Vance, the caddy talked about finding your authentic swing. My son is in acting school. One of his professors created an exercise for the students to find your authentic voice. What about finding your authentic magic? What the heck is magic, anyways? Is it abracadabra? Is it sorcery? Is it wise shaping, as Wicca implies? There is a French saying, pain is the craft entering the apprentice. I share this phrase a lot because, for me, it is illuminating and thought-provoking on many levels. Though at first it seems strange, I think I've come to understand it. A cursory examination tells us the obvious. Learning a craft, whether it's playing the piano or writing software, can be frustrating, infuriating, and just plain difficult. Why? Well, I think it's difficult primarily because we are attempting to shapeshift into a new form. I am, before I begin, a person with 10 fingers. After, I am a person with 10 fingers that know how and where to strike the keys of a piano to create pleasing sounds. I have been shaped by the craft. But is that painful? Where does the pain part come in? Once again, the Tarot of the She offered some insight. I drew Warrior 3, what would be the 3 of Wands in a traditional deck. In this deck, it carries the word alignment. Now, this card is often associated with teamwork or community, the alignment of many things and people together. But in this case, as I was contemplating craft, apprenticeship, and magic, I discovered something else. Pain is the craft entering the apprentice, because the apprentice is not aligned with the spirit of the craft, and the apprentice, especially this one, can be stubborn. Now, let's think about this for a minute. The most malleable among us are the children. Notice how quickly they learn. See how they learn language, how they learn to draw, how they learn to play an instrument, how they learn to surf the internet or play a video game. Their facility for shapeshifting is unencumbered by expectation. Children are natural shapeshifters, free to become whatever suits the moment. In this state, they are as magical as they are vulnerable. Certainly, there is challenge. But is there pain? Look again into a slightly different scene. In this one, there are expectations, possibly from parents, possibly from society. There are goals to achieve, and embarrassment and disappointment if they are not met. Here's where pain appears, externally applied, egoic, and forced. And so we have one source of pain. Pain is the craft entering the shamed apprentice. Growing resistance is natural in this case. And with that resistance, a kind of recoiling from the shaping required of the apprentice by the craft. Pain is the result of the recoiling of the apprentice from the expectations of others in learning the craft. Now let's look once more. There's a subtle shift in the scene, not visible from the outside. Here, we have an apprentice whose shape is nothing like the craft before him. Here we have a natural expressionist painter learning the craft of the accountant. We have the artist learning to march, or the pugilist learning embroidery. Here we have a mismatch between the craft and the natural gifts, the natural shape of the apprentice. And while the alignment is possible, because anything is possible, the shape-shifting required is arduous. Even with the most willing apprentice, we witness the pain of extraordinary transformation. Pain, in this case, is the result of the craft contorting the unnatural apprentice. Two notes of interest before we move on. First, about the pain of circumstance. There is a craft being learned, even in the greatest of discomfort, injustice, and misery. What kind of craft? It may simply be the craft of enduring, or the craft of compassion. In any case, it is a craft that is not natural for the apprentice. It is at least the pain of the unnatural apprentice. It may well be the pain of the shamed apprentice as well. And also an interesting, perhaps singular experience, and that is that of the shapeshifter. The natural shapeshifter will experience very little pain embracing a craft. You may know people like this. They learn everything very quickly, like children, even when they're adults. They seem to have very little ego. This can be a gift, but then a natural shapeshifter may be confused about which craft to learn, and also wonder whether he has mastered it, because his natural gift is to flow and change. He may not know when mastery has been achieved. His bearings aren't the same as ours. His ego is, perhaps, tenuous. Such a being may well experience less pain, but more anxiety and uncertainty. There is a final kind of relationship between craft and apprentice that springs from the first two. It results in the pain of the self-deluded apprentice. The self-deluded apprentice has learned the sting of shame and has embraced goals that are not aligned with his natural self. He may be convinced that he is, or must be, a master of a certain craft, even though it is not so. This delusion can occur because of a deep wound, perhaps from childhood or even a past life, where the apprentice feels a desperate need to have control, to protect, or to project in some aspect of his life. He may struggle with this self-appointed craft for years, unwittingly participating in the reinforcement of his own shame, or contributing and reinforcing some aspect of soul loss as he attempts to force himself into an unnatural shape. What does all this have to do with my magic? Well, I was taught that there are two paths, the path of the shaman and the path of the sorcerer. The path of the sorcerer is crafted by ego. Look around you. Virtually all the technologies we have at our disposal today are the result of acts of sorcery. We choose to build the wheel. We choose to craft a road out of asphalt. We choose to build rockets that go to the moon, the internet, and the iPhone. This is what I call sorcery. It is consensus reality sorcery, for sure. But to paraphrase Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from sorcery. because the only difference is one of perspective. Clever shaping from the ego. Is sorcery necessarily bad? No. Using the elements, bending them to our will, that is quintessentially human. It's in our nature. One could say that it's a form of our natural magic. On the other hand, neither is it good, because it comes from the ego. As we must acknowledge, the human ego is treacherous territory, filled with blindness, soul loss, and woundedness. So any product of the ego is also treacherous territory. We simply unleash that which is within us, amplified through the power of our sorcery. Again, look around. All our sorcery, all our technology, has brought us to where we are today. The path of the shaman, on the other hand, is crafted in communion with compassionate ones, those enlightened spirits that have a better, broader perspective on what course of action is in our best interest and in the best interests of all. Cultivating relationships with these compassionate ones is the key to productive shamanism and is a distinguishing characteristic between shamanism and sorcery. Sorcerers work with elementals that have no opinion or with spirits who are just like you and me, except maybe they don't have physical bodies. Not bad, necessarily, but opinionated and not completely enlightened. Shamans work with compassionate beings who definitely have an opinion and won't help you when they disagree with you. So I was taught anyway, and all of my experiences appear to be quite consistent with this framework. Something is blocking my magic. I had a conversation with my dear teacher, Michael Harner, about this at a time when I was very frustrated with my work in the world. I can't seem to make connection with the spirits to get things done that I want to do, I cried. He responded, maybe you should stop trying to get the spirits to help you with what you want and ask them what they want. Well, to do that, one must relinquish the ego. To do that, one must align oneself with something other than the ego's wishes. The magician reversed is an indication that something is out of alignment. There are three aspects to align: the craft, the apprentice, and the divine will. If you've been developing your gifts and working hard on mastering your craft, but seem still to struggle with bringing your gifts out into the world, I can sympathize. I'm at that very place, it seems, right now. I have done excellent work in learning a variety of crafts. This here apprentice has accepted much pain along the way. As to knowing myself, recently I am becoming more aware of the self-delusions that have compelled me to attempt mastery of crafts that are not easy or natural for me. I have contorted myself as the unnatural apprentice and tortured myself as the self-deluded apprentice for many years. I think I'm finally ready to relinquish these unnatural acts. And yet there is still one act of alignment before me. Alignment with divine will. I know, I trust, that when I have aligned myself, my natural self, with my natural craft, and with divine will, that magician card will turn itself over with no extra effort from me. We'll be right back.
We told you we were expanding. Tune in to the Amethyst Oracle Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Ludmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. And get ready for two more shows. Starting in February, join us for A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella. On the first and third Tuesdays each month at 8 p.m., John will bring together leaders and explorers in neo-shamanism. Practical and practiced, his guests are not just doing shamanism, they're living it. And don't miss What's Your Prescription for Balance with Mildred Lynn McDonald and Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday evening of each month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light, in addition to our original Sunday morning Firefly Willows LIVE anchor shows.
Welcome back. This is Convergence. I'm your host, John Carosella. And with me for today's spirited conversation is Daniel Foer. Daniel is a PhD and an MFT. He leads trainings, rituals, and community circles focusing on honoring ancestors and tending our relations with the natural world and remembering our unique destiny and calling. He also offers individual healing, mentorship sessions, and ministerial services, things like weddings, funerals, birth rituals, home blessings, and so on. Daniel is the founder of the Earth Medicine Alliance, an interfaith, earth-honoring nonprofit, and co-founder of a ritual circle working with mountains around the San Francisco Bay. He's also a priest of Ifa and Obatala in the Ifa Orisha tradition of Yoruba-speaking West Africa and the African diaspora. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. Welcome, John.
So we have been acquaintances for a while, but this is really the first time that we've had a chance to get to know each other across the table. And I kind of chose this moment because I've been thinking about the question, know thyself, and I've been called to get a better understanding of my own magic, the nature of my magic. And I was thinking about, okay, so how do you determine who you are? How do you, what are the tools that you can bring to bear on knowing yourself? And a friend of mine, this was really strange, a friend of mine just happened to you know, we were sitting around goofing off on a Saturday evening, and he said, you know, I just realized you're Italian. You know, he's looking at me, right? And, you know, I have Italian features. And he's like, I never really noticed that before. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting clue. Like, my heritage says something about who I am. And why is that? Why is my heritage relevant to this question? Why and how? And so I thought about ancestors. I thought about the long lineage that connects me to the past, and I just began to wonder, how does that influence who I am? How does that help determine who I am? And maybe that's a clue for how I can know myself. And that led me to you, because you do ancestor work. So can you help me with this question?
Yeah, great. I want to start by deconstructing the question in a couple ways. So if the question is, how do I know myself? How does one know themselves? There are two ways in which the question is loaded. One is it implies the self is singular, and the other is it potentially implies that the self can be known apart from other selves, both of which are suspicious assumptions. And I am coming partly from a background of a student of indigenous wisdom, but also a student of Buddhism and the Dharma to some degree. And from a Buddhist perspective, the notion that the self can exist as an absolutely independent reality apart from other selves is it's seen as an illusion, that there's dependent arising, and that I am a convergence of many different forces, that if you take them all away, there's not necessarily something left. And so to start with, we're embedded in a web of relationships. And so to know yourself in a way, to reframe it slightly, you could say, what's my place? What's my role? What's my unique song or note in the convergence of forces that I'm a part of?
And I gather from the setup that that unique song or note actually does not emanate from a dualistic self. It actually is the result of a whole bunch of convergence of...
Correct, yeah. Yeah, there's no... if there's no one to hear the interview, is Daniel really real? If there's no echo back from the forces that are mirroring a certain kind of you exist energy back to me, am I really real? I'm not convinced that I exist totally separate from other things. Put it that way. I don't have any evidence to support that. And so there might be very deep karmic multiple lifetime energies at a seed level that do continue beyond this life, that connect me to family and the land and all different kinds of things. But even those things are dependent on...
They have their own history.
Yeah, they have their own history, exactly. So, and that's fine. We have a relatively real existence. And so if you start with that assumption that we're embedded in relationships, then you have to start to ask, what are the relationships we're embedded in, if you want to know yourself and know your place? And so from a Western, modern Western cultural point of view, the biggest problem that fuels our ecological meltdown and injustice toward other humans and all the ways in which we're screwing it up on the planet is that only other living human beings are totally real. And even not all of them all the time.
Right,
we tend
right.
to objectify a lot of other people in subtle ways that are sneaky. And so if we only see other living humans as a source of relationship, the alternative is to objectify, say, the spirits of the land, of the elements, of plants and animals, and of the unseen or non-physical beings like ancestors or deities. And so if we, for one, we lose out on potential intimate interactions with those beings when we see them as objects. And we tend to relate with the natural world as an object when we don't see the spirit of the salmon or the land here in the Bay Area as a person, as an I-thou relationship. And so part of the fix or corrective that engaging with indigenous earth-honoring wisdom can bring is that we regrow or reactivate our receptor site or our capacity for intimate relationships with beings that aren't only human. The spirits of the animals, the ancestors, etc. And so once we do that, and it's not like it happens overnight, but once we say, okay, maybe there is a strategic advantage to seeing these other beings as relatives, as community, as other types of persons, even if they're not human persons, and we start to relate accordingly, then the advantage of that is that from their side, we're more fun to be around, we're more relational, we're more conscious, and there can be healing, there can be a greater sense of awareness of place that extends beyond just the living community. And so that's one piece of the fix, is to expand our perception of personhood or of who's a relative, who's family, who's a potential source of intimate connection beyond just living humans.
So there's a couple of things here that I think would be enjoyable for us to explore a little bit. And one is that when we choose to be in relation to, you know, when we choose to admit the possibility of relation,
mm-hmm.
right, with the spirits of the land or with the squirrels or with,
right.
you know, whatever, you know, my first thought is, well, okay, that involves me shifting my consciousness, shifting my focus to embrace them,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think there's, it's like you said, we're more fun to be around,
mm-hmm.
indicates something about the nature of relationship that might go unnoticed when we say this, right? And that is that if we see them as relatives, if we see them as something possible to have relationship with,
mm-hmm.
they respond.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that, mm-hmm. and it's that responsiveness that makes us have more fun.
Yeah. The beings miss out on our company. We live in the Bay Area here, San Francisco Bay Area, and 250 years ago, there were about 20,000, more or less, humans at the time of substantial Spanish contact. And there's about 8 million humans now. And it's my sense that the spirits of this land probably get less or maybe about as much ritual acknowledgement or care or attention today.
With 8 million of us.
Yeah, with 8 million of us than they got 250 years ago. And so it's my read. For one, there's a way in which the spirits of the natural world can be appropriately mistrustful or even angry about past harms. But moving past that level, you know, with acknowledgement to the need for healing there, there's also a way in which they miss the connection.
Yeah, human beings can be pretty interesting.
Yeah, we're part of nature. We're it. This is the earth talking. You know, we're part of the natural world. And so when we accept that and accept our relatedness, then yeah, there's a joy and a sweetness that can come from that, that has psychological and physical health benefits and all that. Yeah.
But how does that help me know myself?
Well, Let me come back to the question of knowing yourself. The other thing I wanted to bring attention to is about the assumption that there's a singular self, there's a singular John to be known.
Mm-hmm.
Many indigenous cultures have an understanding of the soul or the self that's multiple, not singular. We tend, because we're raised in a a culture that's pretty influenced historically by monotheism of Christianity, to assume that the soul is singular. One example from Mongolian Buryat culture, the human soul is actually a convergence of three souls, one of which reincarnates along the bloodline, one of which reincarnates but it doesn't tend to follow the bloodline, and a third of which does not reincarnate, only takes birth once and settles in the natural world upon death. And so there is and there is not reincarnation. Yes, it follows and doesn't follow the bloodlines. And so when you say, how do I know myself on a deep soul level? You say, well, which soul, which stream of soul level consciousness do you want to tune into and identify with? So that's there's a, in that sense, we can't know ourselves apart from knowing the different stories, the different sections in the orchestra that are creating a complex sound that we tend to register as one energy. And so the different souls can bring different karmic or soul level demands or drives to our being. So to know yourself in a way is reframed then as, how do you harmonize the community of energies that are you in a way that keeps the peace?
And keeps the peace where?
Internally.
Internally,
for to start with. Mm-hmm. And then relationally, it, generally speaking, it's like people, generally, as I see it from indigenous cultures, people care less about individual enlightenment and more about being an ethical, useful, and beautiful person. And so people, it's like, okay, so you're enlightened. Who cares? Show us. Show us your enlightenment in action then.
Right.
Be useful. Help people to be happier, healthier,
right.
And, you know, and live in a good way. And so the question of who am I is reframed slightly to, what's my destiny? What's my unique role? What are my original instructions? What's my unique will? Or
what's my magic?
Yeah, what's my magic? Same, yeah. And so how do you answer that question? One way to approach it is, what are the powers, what are the deities, what are the forces of nature from the vast spectrum of forces that we're cooked out of? Which are the ones that are really featured in the recipe that is John, that is Daniel? So what's the starting question is, what powers are you aligned with? You could say traditionally, what clan are you a part of? What spiritual society within a larger culture is your medicine aligned with? That's a basic typology kind of thing that exists in a lot of indigenous cultures. It's like, oh, you're a child of Obatala, or you're a part of the water clan, or you're part of this, you know, you're a dreamer, so you should connect with other people who dream strongly. And so asking, what are my unique gifts and talents? What are my natural affinities? What are my natural strengths? That's one way to start to approach the question of, how do I know myself? Because then it gives a perspective on how you can start to convert your natural strengths into actions or ways of showing up that benefit others, whether they're human or other than human, that you're able to drink in the supportive community long enough until you get strong spiritually and get insight into what you're here to do. And as that insight comes more and more to fruition, then you can convert it into benefit for that community that's been supporting you.
You know, as you say that, I experience a kind of deep relaxation of knowing myself is as straightforward as loving myself. And by that, I'm drawn to, like, tending to the parts of myself that are fun, that are joyful, that are, you know, what I'm good at, and giving myself without judgment to those things that I'm good at. As a simple and practical, and it's not self-indulgence, it's, oh, these are the ingredients in the recipe that are featured in the construction, or you know, the instruments in the song that are featured.
Yeah. Something I love about indigenous traditions, generally speaking, is that there's a respect for difference and diversity. people are not expected to all be the same. What a nightmare if we had to all be the same. And so the memo is like, be yourself. Actually, it's not an option. It's a moral obligation. We insist that you be yourself. Because if you're not being yourself, you're going to be annoying to other people. Because you're going to be fighting and kicky and unhappy and taking your unhappiness out on other people. And two, you're going to be less useful, less effective. Your soul's going to be in a state of rebellion. So there's the guidance is basically like, get to know your own nature, accept that. Accept that it's going to be different than some other people. Accept that it might be different from what you think you ought to be based on cultural conditioning and your family and every other thing. Women, for example, who happen to be a strong warrior spirit by nature.
Right.
That can be challenging to accept because the culture gives strong guidance on how women are supposed to be in more and less obvious ways. And so that can be a harder one to accept. Same for men who are very stereotypically feminine by temperament and culturally have a strong message that they need to be very stereotypically masculine. And right, so when your soul comes into conflict with the outer culture, that can be hard to embrace. But until you embrace it, you're going to be a pain in the butt to people around you and not very happy. And so that congruence, there is a relief. There is a relaxation that comes from a culture whose elders, when they're healthy, I'm generalizing again about earth-honoring cultures, and other cultures right, carry this to different degrees, where the message is be yourself and don't be our version of what we say you need to be. Really dig in there and be yourself. And that is what will lead you to the most effective service. That's what will lead you to have the best chance at longevity and good health. Because you're
there's this tension in me right now that reflects on, well, people being themselves. If you say be yourself, there's a lot of people that are wounded and dysfunctional, right? And so the commission to go be yourself, included in that commission is the dysfunction that you currently are.
Yeah.
This is a key part of the nature of the question, right? I don't want to know myself. I don't want to know myself as I am now, particularly.
Right.
I want to know myself as my highest implementation, my most elegant implementation of myself.
Right.
Because that's the one that has the magic that is the purest and the most accessible and the most productive in this world.
Right.
I don't want to leverage the dysfunctional versions of John. I want to leverage the healed, whole version of John.
Right. Well, often, I'll give an example from Ifa Orisha tradition. I've been ritually read as through divination and subsequently initiated as a priest of Obatala. Obatala is just one of maybe a dozen archetypal forces of nature, Orisha, that are really actively worked with, even though there are many powers. And so through that initiation, part of the message to me is be yourself. Be that, the reading implies that my Ori, my personal head, my personal temperament is most in alignment with that force relative to other forces. And that rings true for me. And any given force may show up in Irei or with blessings or with Ibi or potentially more blocked or out of balance or in the less awesome expression of that. And so by being identified as part of that clan, so to speak, or part of that specialization within the larger community, it's saying that I also need to watch for the ways in which that shows up out of balance. And so...
No, you had the good fortune of having someone read you and guide you to that notion of self and gift.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
For those of us who don't have that, where do we get our reading?
One of the things I've done with people at times, it's my sense, this is not just an Orisha tradition, but a lot of other traditions recognize that we structurally have a direct relationship with Divine Mother and Father consciousness, with masculine and feminine in deep structural ways. And there's, let's say, at least a dozen ways that the masculine and the feminine can show up at any given time, like big archetypes, big patterns in the collective experience of humans. And so those can be really intense or energetically hot, really mellow and dreamy, really quick and mercurial, or really grounded and patient. And so for each person, if we don't have a vocabulary, then we can't start to answer the question. And so I would say for each person, identify a dozen different archetypes, different forces, deities, energies that express the masculine for you and express the feminine for you. And you could imagine walking around a circle and looking at these different really cultivated elders and powers.
Right, right.
And one might be a really thin, tall, cool, lunar priestess energy, who's very different than the earth mama. And
right,
who's
right.
very different than the volcanic, destructive, fiery goddess of justice. And so get to know and appreciate what are the options?
Right, right.
Who are the different like elder beings in the circle that
right.
you could potentially vibe with? And if you flesh that out and notice who's in the circle and imagine walking around it, you'll notice that some you feel naturally seen by and naturally close with, and other ones you might feel allergic reaction to.
That's cool.
And so what deities, what powers have aversion for you?
Mm.
And that might mean that there's actually a deep connection there. The ones that you feel really neutral about is probably not, you have less work to do there.
Right, right.
But if you feel a strong yes, wow, I feel really seen by that, or a strong no, then there's probably work there. Like for me with Ubatala, there's a part of me that could sit alone for hours and hours and hours and just organize things into categories. It's a little bit like there's a savant, like I could be happy with that Vulcan streak in my being. And by having that called out, it's like, it's okay, Daniel, that you're also like that. I mean, don't dwell on that all the time, but...
acknowledge it.
Yeah, acknowledge it. And there's a part of my psyche that's a lot more like the elaborate structure of a crystal than like something really messy and
flowing.
And flowing. Yeah.
Right.
And that's okay.
That's evidenced by the fact that you got your PhD.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm very systematic, very organized about stuff. And it usually serves me well. And it's like saying, careful, Daniel, make sure you're in balance about that.
So it's not so much that you accept wholeheartedly or reject wholeheartedly any aspect, but that you acknowledge those aspects and seek to experience them in harmony.
Yeah.
So maybe the dysfunctions through which we suffer are really aspects of ourselves that are out of balance.
Yes. Many people, to talk about it in a Jungian psychology framework, are unconsciously possessed by the powers we're talking about. And so they come out in sloppy and chaotic ways. And one of the only ways, for example, let's say there was a woman who wanted to enlist my support and was very having a lot of conflictual relationships and feeling bad about that. And through intuition, divination, it was my read that she is a natural warrior by temperament, but feels really frightened and unwilling to embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, what the fix is to bring it more conscious, to honor that power.
Exercise it.
So you get
to understand
to bring it out so it's not coming out sideways.
Mm.
And to really claim it. Be like, okay, you're a badass warrior. Be that, really. And all this other stuff will quiet down for you. And so sometimes it's that the forces are coming through, but because they can't consciously really be seated or really be settled, then they come out sideways in problematic ways. If someone's really struggling with like addiction and sort of hedonistic tendencies, it might be like, look, you're a child of the love goddess. You need to be the biggest queen and artist and creative, colorful, take up a lot of space person that you can be. And some of this will quiet down. It's like embrace the archetype in its fullness.
It's kind of terrifying, though, to do that because of the sense of the risk that you might lose yourself in that archetype.
Well, you're already being ridden by it when you're in that condition.
Right.
Embracing it consciously is a kind of depossession. It's a way of being in relationship instead of being unconsciously identified with the force.
Right. Instead of being ridden by it, you choose to co-create with it or dance with it.
Exactly. It's like that with ancestors, too. I tell people, and I don't mean to be a jerk about it, but I tell people that either you have a conscious or unconscious relationship with your ancestors. Those are kind of the two options. You don't get to not have a relationship. I mean, you cannot. Yeah, you cannot have a conscious relationship with them.
Right.
In which, let's say you don't have a shrine, you don't have an altar, you don't have any outward way at all that you honor them in your life. So, as a result, you're the altar. You're the place where they manifest through the body, through your actions, through your desires, through your relationships. Because there's nowhere that they're seated. So it's an unconscious relationship. When one of the advantages of having an altar is that you create a space for that force in your life and you symbolically say, I'm not that energy. I'm in relationship with that energy. So therefore, the ancestors live just a few feet away from me at the ancestor altar and not in my body all the time. Of course, they're here as well, but there's more breathing room. It can be relational. Yeah.
So let's take a short break and come back and talk a little bit more about ancestors.
Good.
And the ways that we can be in relationship with ancestors and reflect a little bit more about relationship.
Good.
All right, so we'll be right back.
Yep.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi-C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi-C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
We're back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella, together with Daniel Foer of the Earth Medicine Alliance. And Daniel, before the break, we were talking about ancestors and the idea of having a relationship with the ancestors, mm-hmm. whether you want one or not,
right?
Conscious or unconscious, and the idea of the ancestor altar and how the ancestor altar can give you some breathing room. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Sure. With respect to ancestors, when I bring up that topic, I'm limiting it basically to our human ancestors, because some people will use that word to be very inclusive, which is fine. And so I'm making a distinction that I'm talking about all the collective consciousness of human that's not currently physically embodied. And so it's the other half of our being. You can think of human as having one foot in the visible and one in the invisible, and the whole organism is both. And so ancestors is the our other side that's not in bodies right now. And so generally with ancestors, there's a couple different types. One would be the ancestors of the land, of the place where you live, which are not always our ancestors of blood. And then there's ancestors of affinity or of lineage, ancestors that aren't related by blood, that might be more of a tradition or a friend that's passed or someone who's inspired us. And all those are important, but the type of ancestor work or ancestor focus that I give the most weight to is ancestors of blood or of family, because sometimes adoptive family is just as much family, even though they're not technically blood related. So when I step people through ancestor work, which is a big focus of what I do, the way that I approach that is stepping people through what I've come to call a lineage repair cycle, which involves participants choosing one quarter of their blood ancestry, so their father's father's people or mother's father's people, etc., and to focus on that quarter of their blood ancestry until the recent and older ancestors are well in spirit, elevated, bright, loving, supportive, and they indicate to the participant, it's good, we're well, focus on another quarter now. And so there's a systematic working through the four sides of the family until you get to a place where you know your recent dead, your remembered ancestors, and the more distant ancestors who need care still. They're well. They've joined the ancestors. They're not ghosts. They're not in a heavy condition. They're not in a troubled condition. Once you've arrived at that point, then the relationship resets back to more of a relationship of maintenance and of natural receiving from the ancestors as the junior to their elderhood, because that's structurally there are elders.
So what is the net result of repairing the lineage? What happens on the earth plane for us?
A lot can happen. For one, energies that have been heavy in our field, in our aura, in our lives, in our psyche, are lifted. So we're not feeling the weight of unhappy or unwell dead from our family. So on a metaphysical spirit level, the energy is lighter. Two, our perception of our family is almost always improved. And it doesn't mean we open ourselves up to abuse. If our family is abusive, you know, it can actually lead to more healthy boundaries. But our family is then seen in the context of ancestors. So we don't expect our biological mother and father anymore to embody the divine mother and father. We see that they are just one point in a river of consciousness, and we can relate with our grandmothers and grandfathers, spiritually speaking, directly, and get that loving mother-father energy through the collective wisdom of lineage in a way that takes the pressure off our families, our immediate family.
Uh-huh.
And that can be very supportive to forgiveness and seeing our parents in a more human light. And we are freed up to live our lives without the heavy, subtle, I'm a victim of my childhood story that so many people hold on to because they aren't sure how to transform that old pain.
Right, right.
Yeah, and the ancestors help us to get clear about the question of our unique destiny, because often we are carrying on some kind of positive gift or legacy from them. Often we're doing that unconsciously.
Right, and unconsciously, and so yeah. We don't actually know that it's there, so we can't bring it forward.
Right. Or it comes through naturally. A lot of people who are leading awesome, balanced lives are just spontaneously embodying the good from their people. Yeah.
Hmm.
And so it gives us choice, too, to not unconsciously play out stories that are not helpful from them.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot. It can lead to direct family healing and repair as well.
Yeah, so it's in relationship, again, this idea of knowing oneself comes into bloom mm-hmm. when you know yourself in relation to your lineage.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just want to touch on this a little bit more. You said the ability to work with your ancestors takes the pressure off your immediate parents to be divine mother, divine father.
Yeah.
And that struck me as opening a gate to a long path that leads back to divine source through the lineage.
The rites of passage for adolescents in at least some, if not many, indigenous cultures very explicitly put the adolescent in direct communion with the god, goddess, consciousness, however that culture conceives of it, so that they don't remain developmentally stuck in the place of trying to get that from other living humans. One of the big problems in intimate relationships is we're wanting our partner to be the goddess or the divine masculine, and it's totally unreasonable if we do that. And it is a way of masking our own need to be directly in communion with those forces. One of the, if you look even at like Tibetan Buddhist tantric practice, there's a whole cycle of mother tantra and father tantra that precedes the non-dual tantric work. And the implication of that, as I understand it, I'm not a teacher of that tradition, is that one needs to really have activated those two sides of the psyche in order to have the child of our authentic self, of our unique self be born. In a more shamanic vocabulary, for me, I see developmentally a need for us to relate well with the earth, what's below, with the stars, with the heavens, with the cosmic forces, and with humanity. And the human as a mode of consciousness is a child of heaven and earth, of Mother Earth and Father Sky. And so the work is to relate well with the land, with the plants, animals, powers, elements, where we're at, all the forces of nature, to relate well with the transcendent, with the deity, with the many energies that are underlying what we're made of, and to remember our destiny in that way, and to bring that together in our unique human mode of consciousness, so we're not annoying too much to other people, so we know how to love other people and take in their love. We know how to be ethical, be sensible, pay our bills, vote even, and how to navigate human consciousness. And so,
and this comes simply from knowing oneself.
Well, if the self is at the center of the circle, the way to know what's at the center of the circle is not to sit at the center of the circle. You need to go all over the place and expand how the circumference of it, and to see you can't know yourself fully without knowing the stars or the weird Dumbo octopus at the bottom of the ocean, or knowing how to forgive your father, or how to pay your bills, and how to navigate all these different demands from different domains of reality, all of which are sacred, some of which we like, some of which we dislike, but they're all part of what we are. There's nothing outside the self. There's nothing foreign to the self. And so whatever you think is not you is points to something that you haven't yet recognized as part of you. Yeah,
because whatever is out there is in some form or fashion interacting with you and asking for some kind of conscious response.
It's part of the story. Not all the relatives, not all the different kinds of people are friendly. Some wish to kill us and, you know, revel in the energy of fear and death. And you don't want to invite those energies into your home, but they're your relative. They're still part of our extended family. And so I frame the question of knowing oneself more as knowing your place, knowing your role, knowing your particular unique work and song and trajectory in the larger web of beings.
And that exercise of discovering your song is not an exercise you do alone.
Correct.
Correct.
That's part of the reality check. Sometimes people think that there's a lot of wounded people in spiritual circles, and I used to be more so one of those people. And one of the things that'll happen is people believe that they have discovered themselves, and they may genuinely be tapping into a really expanded type of consciousness, but the response back is who cares a little bit if you're not showing up well, if you can't ground it in a way that brings love and benefit and beauty into other people's lives, then it's not a benefit, I guess. And so the reality check on whether or not our self-knowledge has become useful is others and other beings, and whether or not you bring happiness to others through how you show up. Yeah,
it's very sweetly profound that knowing oneself both compels and requires it, the interaction with the world.
Yeah, the ethic that I've encountered that to me is the most, I don't know, it sounds snobby when I say evolved, but I'll own my judgment there. So the most evolved articulation of a human potential that I've encountered is the Bodhisattva teachings in Mahayana Buddhism, so Zen, Tibetan, other lineages of Buddhism. And as I understand it, in a nutshell, the bodhisattva vow, an ideal that one aspires to embody, is an ethic of profound non-abandonment. Basically says that I will return again, again, and again to birth, presumably human birth, but maybe not, could be any different form, in order to just be with all the beings who are still suffering and may not know themselves yet and may need a companion and may need care. And I'm not running away. Spirituality is not about getting out of here. It's about mustering the courage to never abandon another being and to keep showing up again and again and again and again. And as I understand it, you can arrive at that ideal two general ways. One is through great love and compassion, and that says, like, why would I possibly want to leave my child? And if every being is my child and my mother, I'm not going to do that. I commit to being here. Like, and another way of arriving at it is through getting theologically or religiously just checkmated around the idea that you can have individual enlightenment, that you, John, or I could be enlightened while other beings are suffering. It implies that there's some fundamental separation between you and others,
which is an illusion.
And if that's an illusion, if you really examine it and you're like, man, I haven't found a way to substantiate that I'm totally separable from other beings, then individual enlightenment is like the left hand is saying it's happy while the right hand is bleeding. And there's it doesn't make any sense to pursue it. It's suddenly individual enlightenment looks like cowardice. It looks like running, unless it's motivated by a desire to become more effective at helping others.
Right.
And so there's a thing that for me that's very instructive. It's like, don't run away, come back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fall in love with the world and other beings, and then ask, how can you help
them? How can I help?
Yeah, what's needed?
You want to know yourself? Ask how you can help.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what's my place? Well, I'm not sure what my place is. Well, what's needed? That's a good start.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're almost out of time. Mm-hmm. Is there anything any last thought you'd like to share with our audience?
With respect to earth-honoring spirituality, one thing I've noticed, this is what comes to mind right now, is we have to get good at tracking our bliss, tracking what brings us joy, makes us happy. If you love dreams, then go for that. Use that as your inroad to the bigger, full, holistic picture of the spiritual path. If you love plants, go with that. If you love, you know, whatever it is. So there are lots of ways in, and the important thing is to find one or two that work for you.
And that bring you joy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, if the spiritual path isn't generally making your life better and more fulfilling and helping you to feel more yourself and more happy, you're doing it wrong.
So, and that's okay. Just
yeah, it's okay to do it wrong. Yeah, but then just, like, you know, have higher standards. It's okay to want your life to get better. It doesn't mean you necessarily have more money and all those things, but you might. But there's no spirituality is not a separate thing from life.
Mm.
And so it's about helping your life to be more loving and effective. So,
good counsel. Good counsel. So, if folks want to get to know more about you or your work or want to reach out to you, how can they do
that? My personal practice and website is at ancestralmedicine.org. And I'm also the founder and on the board of a nonprofit called the Earth Medicine Alliance. And the website for that organization is earthmedicine.org.
Great.
Yeah.
All right, we'll have those on the website for folks.
Great. Yeah.
Daniel, thank you so much for a very stimulating, enlightening conversation.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
We'll be in touch again soon.
Great.
And we'll be right back.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out John's previous programs or shows from one of our other hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald or Heisey Lutmers. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us.
So, I've learned a lot in the making of this show. Debbie came out blazing in the roundtable with a powerful divine feminine answer to my question. It pretty much was, that's not a question you can answer by questioning or questing. It's something you understand about yourself as you live your life. And isn't that the point? It was hard to argue with that kind of wisdom, huh? And Daniel 4 was equally direct. He said, you can't know yourself as yourself. You can really only come to know yourself through knowing your place in the world. And that is dependent on the relationships you have. Knowing yourself, knowing your unique gifts and your personal magic, can't be done in a vacuum. So all my efforts to know myself by looking inward, seeking a kind of absolute, whole, pristine character, would seem to be naive at best. So I guess I can say that I've learned something about the process of getting to know oneself. And I've also had a moment or two to reflect on the facts on the ground, so to speak. If I really am an expression of the relationships I've cultivated, not just with humans, but with everything I consider alive, then one thing is certain. I'm just at the beginning. So much of my effort has been in looking for an abstract answer. This turn of events, well, it doesn't exactly take me back to square one, but it does call for a re-examination of the data I've been accumulating. So what do I know about myself? For starters, I'm a man. Not a guy. A man. When I turned 50, folks asked me how old I felt. I said, I feel 50. A vibrant and alive and healthy 50. But I feel 50. I'm not a kid anymore, and I'm not a young Turk on his way up. I've been through my midlife crisis, and I know the difference between being on this side of it and being on the other side of it. Pretty soon, I'll be celebrating my second Saturn return. I'm starting to feel like a man. I'm starting, I think, to act like one, too. I'm also a father. It's taken me a long time to really understand what it means to be a father. And I'm fortunate that my kids are still close enough that I can offer, finally, some quality stuff from my experience. Being a father means all those cliche things. It's really humbling that I get to be one, and I'm deeply grateful. I'm also a mate. I have an amazing counterpart. My spouse is probably the most beautiful, rich, and fascinating thing in my life. Has been for some 28 years, it seems. Finally, I'm starting to see her that way. What else? I'm a son and a brother. My father passed recently. It was an honor to be his son. I miss him deeply. To my brothers and sisters, both blood and spirit, I say, I'm here. I honor each of you. And as part of those connections, I've recently recognized once again that I'm an Italian. By blood and culture, the great river of Italian heritage is in my veins. The food, the music, the art, the passion, and the romance. There's something about leaning into this heritage that is comfortable. It's something I haven't fully appreciated for quite a few years, but it's still there. The warmth, the hospitality, the daring do. I see my romantic, adventuresome willingness to be in the limelight self and say, hey, that guy's Italian, and he's wearing that Italian suit, and it looks good on him. And there's another aspect of myself that fits my Italian persona, and this one goes very deep. I connect to it most directly through my mother, but I know it's there all the way around, all the way back. And that is, I'm a gardener. You know, I call myself a physicist, a shamanist, and I have cause to suspect I'm a sorcerer of sorts. And yet these are all things I've sought out. Sure, they're part of my nature. Even from the time I was a child, I was taking things apart to see how they worked and
and wondering about God and probing the deepest questions of the universe that my little self could conjure. But more than any of those, naturally, I'm a gardener. I've been cultivating myself all these years, very deliberately and intensively, if not always judiciously. Seeing growth happen and helping it along, watching it flower and bear fruit. Oh, I love it. And cultivating beauty is what I love to do most of all. This, for me, is an act of deep intimacy. And it is what I love to do. I'm a gardener. In my heart, I'm a gardener. And finally, as I look at the tools that God has given me, and how I use them, and what is closest to me, I recognize that all along, I've had one very personal, intimate, beautiful gift. Sometimes I've exercised it fully, joyously. Sometimes, as a consequence of deep pain and confusion, I've set it aside. But as I've connected to this spiritual path once again, and awakened from my slumber of delusion, I'm embracing it again now. And that gift is my voice. I think it's the reason that when I was just a little tyke, Mighty Mouse was my superhero of choice. You know, he's the only superhero who sings on his way into battle. So I speak, and I write, and I sing. I sing when I'm happy. I sing when I'm sad. I sing when I do healing work. In fact, whenever I'm restless, or confused, or really anything, if I sing, it makes things better. I sing when I'm whole. I sing. Who am I? I'm starting to remember.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, join Heisi Luttmers and John Carosella for live on-air readings. They'll be consulting the tarot, runes, and animal medicine to offer guidance for your questions. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.